Welcome to the Gordon Asset Management Podcast, a show for savers, investors, and entrepreneurs, helping you to stay informed, invest wisely, and achieve the unimaginable. Now, on to the show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Gordon Asset Management Podcast. This is Todd Zeppel, and with me, Joe Gordon today. First, let's talk about asset class returns. So 2020, this is pretty crazy to think. Small caps were up 20% in the year 2020. Year to date, small caps are actually doing pretty well, up close to 6%. Emerging markets up 18%. Again, crazy to think that year to date, emerging markets have continuing to perform up over 4.5%. Large cap, of course, did very well, up 18%. Developed market year to date has done very well. So as you can see, the worst sectors or the worst asset classes were REITs down 5%, commodities down 3%, cash, of course, pays nothing. Of course, when we look at all this data, again, the main point behind this is if you have a fully diversified portfolio, you had your assets diversified all across all these asset classes, you would have received a decent return with generally lower volatility. Joe, any thoughts on this piece?
No, I mean, a lot of people are saying, oh, you should allocate to emerging market equity. That's the best asset class to be, especially in the backdrop of a weakening dollar. And that did play well in the last half of 2020. However, to the far right of this chart, if you look at 15-year returns, you see that emerging market equity return just under 7% a year, but it's tops in volatility at 23% standard deviation. So the problem with American investors going to emerging market equity is that many times you're buying state-owned enterprises, you're not getting something that you think you're getting. And so typically Americans are underinvested there. And the same would go with developed markets outside the U.S. For the same reasons, but a little bit different. Developed markets outside the U.S. do not have as heavy a technology weighting in their indices as does the S&P 500, which now technology is pushing 28%. So factor performance, this is everybody who ever looked at any business show, Fox Business, CNBC, what have you, Bloomberg, knows that it was a momentum market in 2020. And so clearly you can see in this chart under 2020, momentum led the way. And while year to date through 11 days or so, small caps leading the way and values leading the way, there is a talk of a reversal going on and that the two sectors that did the worst last year of the S&P 500, energy and financials actually will lead this year, and that is the case so far. But overall, momentum was all anyone wanted to talk about. Small caps were way down in the March-April drawdown, but they rallied beginning strongly in September through the end of this year. And we had said on numerous occasions small caps needed to rally because generally they lead in a secular bull market rally. Not a bull market in a rally, short rally in a bear market. So that's good to see. But overall in 2020, the things that are safe, defensive stocks, high dividend stocks, value, were awful. They were last place. And so people that thought they weren't taking much risk didn't make much return. And so therefore there's a big variability in returns based on who plowed into technology and stay-at-home stocks.
Yeah, so just to sum that up, value out the window, MOMO and FOMO, momentum and fear of missing out, was what really performed well last year. Looking at the S&P 500, so the market has continued to rally on, sitting at about 3,800 as of today, about 22.5 times forward earnings. Which is crazy to think. You know, you look at, we went through a 34% drawdown, and off the lows, we're actually up 70%-ish. So it's been a wild ride in 2020, to say the least. It's been exhausting for us.
Yeah, there are a lot of people that think that, and you see the talking heads again on television, that the market's got more upside to expand. And you see the top chart shows the forward price earnings multiple at 22.5 times as of January 11th. If you go back to 2000 on the far left, you see the forward PE actually peaked at 27 times. And what's different between these two periods in time is that back in 2000, even with that high multiple, you had much higher interest rates. Today, we have zero bound rates. And so the thinking is that the 22 could go to 28 or even 30 times. It would not be necessarily unreasonable based on zero cost of money. Here's a chart we've had up before. And again, if you look at the very top line shaded in blue, you can see that energy is only 2.5% of the S&P 500 now. On the far left, and you can see over on the far right, the second from the far right, utilities is only 2.7%. And then financials is the third from the far left is 10.8%. Financials back in 2007 approached 30% of the S&P index before the financial crisis. Obviously, things go to extremes. Technology is now 27, and if you add communication services is technology-like, you're at 37% combined of the S&P. So overall, the main thing to look at this year so far, quarter to date, energy is the best sector, up over 11% year to date in 2 weeks. Materials up 5.7. There's your value tilt, global economy reopening. Financials with interest rates going up, net interest margins expanding. Doing better. And again, financials and energy were the two worst sectors in 2020 and only rallied about a third off their bottom in, with the vaccine rally beginning in November. So clearly the data seems to say there is a market rotation. Technology is flat out of the gate this year.
It's crazy to think. Energy's had a great year so far, and it's only a week into the into 2021. Valuations are starting to look frothy, as Joe mentioned, you know, with interest rates being so low. What is a reasonable price to earnings metric? We mentioned earlier the S&P 500 is currently around 22.5 times forward earnings. When we look at other valuation metrics, cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio, Cape-Shiller PE, sitting around 34.5%. The 25 average is around 27.5. So valuations by most measures are indeed getting stretched. But again, to Joe's point, what is a stretch valuation in a zero bound interest rate world?
Well, one thing for sure, though, if interest rates do continue to climb and we have a 2% 10-year treasury in any time in the next 3 to 6 months, probably you'll see valuations start to decline, which means prices are going to decline, especially of the momentum stocks.
S&P 500 index concentration and value. So as Joe mentioned, the top 10% that were the top 10 stocks in the S&P 500 currently make up about 28% of that index, which is pretty crazy. You know, going back to the late 90s, early 2000s, we're kind of right at about those levels. When we look at the PE ratios of those top 10 companies, they're actually above the average for the rest of the S&P. Again, the S&P is around 22.5 times current times forward earnings. The top 10 are around 32.5%. So things are looking a little bit frothy, especially in that top 10 group.
Yeah, and take a couple case studies. Apple being one. Up through 2018, they more or less were valued as a hardware company making iPhones primarily, and traded around 14 to 16 times, maybe 16 to 18 times earnings. Now they've been coordinated as a service company, software company, and so now they're trading at a multiple of 36 to 40 times forward earnings. And guess what? They haven't grown revenue nor earnings. So Wall Street's just decided they're worth a lot more, and people have paid up, and the stock was up big last year and is trading at a 35 to 40 times earnings multiple. So when you have the top 10 trading at, on average, 33 times earnings and the other 490 trading at 20, that's why some people are saying the stock market's really not overvalued. It's just you need the other participants, the other 490 stocks, to start participating in the rally.
The Citigroup Euphoria Panic Indicator showing market exuberance. You know, we've looked at this several podcasts in the past. When we look at this chart going back to the late 80s, it's basically off the charts, all-time highs in a euphoric direction. So, you know, investors want to be in the market right now. They don't want to be in bonds. We're starting to see some money come out of bond funds and flows into equity. ETFs and mutual funds are also up in a big way. Another sign of the euphoria, IPOs in 2020 were half as seasoned as their predecessors. So on average, companies going public had been around for about 5 years when the average has been closer to 10 years. So I think a lot of founders are looking to, well, I think they look into the market and see the froth, see the fervor, see the euphoria, and they don't want to wait around. They want a piece of the action.
Yeah, and virtually any IPO that had the word cloud associated with it was coordinated, and Snowflake being a poster child was up huge the first day of trading. But one of the things about IPOs that's interesting to me has been they have some competition now in the form of SPACs, or special purpose acquisition companies or vehicles. And generally, it's a lot cheaper to bring companies to market using a SPAC. And that's why they're also known as blank check companies. And one of the things about the IPO marketplace that retail investors hate is they never can get an allocation to shares. They have to buy at the market open. The stock's already up 100%. They're way overpaying, and then they get creamed when people start to sell. So if you think about IPOs in general, the way they've been handled in the past, for the most part, you have a roadshow. Each institution says they'll step up to the plate. They only give allocations to their best customers. And then they all double their money in day one and then sell and laugh as retail investors pick up the pieces.
That's the sad and unfortunate truth. To some degree, it's the cult of personality with these SPACs. We have these big name investors, and if they put their name on it, people will buy the SPAC regardless of whether they know what's in it or not. And quite frankly, the way that SPACs work, you don't know what's in this company until it's publicly announced. So it's crazy to think that there's these investment vehicles out there that you can just throw your money in, but you know absolutely zero about.
What was your favorite SPAC of 2020?
I think Chamath Palihapitiya rolled out a couple SPACs, and I think they're all listed under IPO and then another letter, IPOA, IPOB, IPOC. They've been a series of home runs, and the latest one he announced was SoFi, which I think is a good company, a great idea to go public. Will it be another one of these high flyer stocks trading at very high valuations? Yeah, probably.
Yeah, well, my favorite was Nikola.
Yeah.
No one ever knew the truck wasn't driving on its own.
Yeah.
Until it stopped.
That's right.
And the CEO is now gone. So anyway.
Crazy. Yeah. You know, I have this running joke with one of my friends. Hey, we should start a company that, you know, is cloud-based, AI, EV, fintech company, and it doesn't matter what it does, people are going to buy it like crazy, because that's kind of the environment we're in right now. Small caps versus large caps. Again, we've started to see this rotation started late October, November, and it's continued into this year. The chart that we have in front of us is pretty interesting to look. I like the chart in the lower right. It says historic markets drawdown in the next 12 months rebound. When we look at the tech bubble in large cap sold off 49% that year, and then in the following 12 months was up 35%. Small caps in the tech bubble were down 43, so down a little bit less, and up 61% in the following 12 months. So that's what we had been talking about, that small caps typically lead your way out of recessions or market declines. Same with the global financial crisis, 2008. Large caps were down 57%, ended the next year, next 12 months up 72. Small caps down 59%, but up 97%. So almost double your money in the following 12 months. When we look at the COVID recession, large caps were down about 34% on average. What will we see in the next 12 months? I don't know. Small caps, same thing, down 40%, so down more. Are we going to see a double in the next 12 months? I don't know. It's hard to say. But if history is our guide, the next 12 months should be fairly good. Returns by valuation and style. Joe, do you have any comments on this?
Yeah, a couple worth noting. And again, most people want to know what happened in 2020. So if you look at the bottom left two graphs, you can see what market returns since the peak in February 2020 on the left. And obviously, small growth did the best since the market peak, 35%. And growth in general stomp value. That's what everybody's been reading in the press. To the right, since the market low of 2020, you can see small cap growth again up 119%, but small value up just under 100%. So anything small cap has over 100% returns, followed by mid caps just right behind it, and large caps, especially value, did the worst. So, you know, overall, it's been a growth market since 2015. A momentum growth market, and we'll see if that's starting to flatten out a little bit now.
So this chart I thought was pretty interesting. I hadn't viewed the data this way before, but it shows sector share of GDP, employment, and S&P 500. So the chart on the left shows nominal GDP in the fourth quarter of 2020. So it shows the breakdown. Obviously, government spending was the biggest chunk. Industrials were 18% of industrials and materials, 18% of GDP, financial services, 22% of GDP, et cetera. Tech, only 6% contribution to GDP. And then you look at the middle column, which shows actual employment in each one of those sectors. So, the biggest one is government. Industrials, 18%, consumer staples, 15%, healthcare, 14%. Technology makes up only a very small slice of employment, 2%. And then when you look at the actual makeup of the S&P 500, tech just absolutely dominates, 38% of the S&P 500, which is obviously incongruent to the employment, only 2%, and the nominal GDP contribution, 6%. So very interesting to see the data presented this way. I think the big outlier is clearly technology here.
Yeah, and I would say it's the Bobo market, and people are willing to overpay to own technology at any price. And so when you have only 2% of the employment and you're 38% technology and communication services of the index, that tells you things are a little stretched.
Yeah. Well, that's not to say that, you know, the future is technology, right? So there's obviously growth there. Also on the employment situation, the Economic Policy Institute put out some interesting numbers recently that shows about 27 million workers are still affected by COVID. There's roughly 11 that are still officially unemployed. There's 7.5 million that are experiencing some reduced pay or cut in hours. About 5 million people dropped out of the labor force. 3.7 is kind of a fudge number. Maybe they're unemployed but misclassified or not in the labor force anymore. So the real number when we're looking at unemployment is probably closer to 27 million, or at least affected by COVID.
Yeah, and one contrasting thing that's not on this chart is that for people, there are over 6.5 million job openings available in the U.S., but apparently most of the workers that you see in this graph are not qualified to fill those positions, and that's a problem.
Right, the training gap. Small businesses remain weak. So employment and small business, you know, we're back to where we were back in June in terms of employment and trending downward. You know, so this recession has been great for the Amazons of the world, but not so great for any small business in Main Street America.
One thing they got right in this recent stimulus 2.0 bill, if you can argue anything they got right, since $1.4 trillion is going outside the country and only $900 billion and staying in for COVID relief for actual American taxpayers, was the fact that they are allowing companies that got PPP loans in round one to fully expense you don't have to declare it. You can write off the expenses. Before you couldn't,
right.
And now you can. So, but since they got right, what they got right though is in round two, you have to have a revenue loss to qualify for a PPP loan. It's fascinating to me how many law firms and medical firms got PPP loans. Again, medical somewhat, they had an excuse they were deemed non-essential. But the real suffering folks out there, the mom and pops that run restaurants, bars, gyms, nail salons, and things like that, who are basically told you can't work and tough that you don't get paid.
Yeah. You know, and we purposely hadn't waded into the political waters on this podcast. Obviously, it's damned if you do. Probably not damned if you don't. So that's why we avoided it. But, you know, I think when I look at the landscape of everything going on and the disruption and insurrection on both sides of the spectrum, you know, a lot of this I think is a result of some of these economic policies. You know, we've outsourced jobs to the Asian countries for decades, right? And it's great. You can buy a cheap TV, right? You can buy 50-inch flat screen TV for a couple $100, but you know, all those good paying jobs left the Rust Belt. And so I think we have large segments of the population that are fed up over that. There's other segments of the population that have suffered in different ways. And you know, when I look at some of this COVID relief and whatnot, it's all just geared towards a temporary sugar high, right? When we look at China and how they came out of the financial crisis back in 2008, their own version of it. You know, they spent a lot of money on infrastructure. They were building cities and, you know, building roadways, and sometimes people didn't show up and they were just abandoned. But at the end of the day, they were building infrastructure, which pushed the economy forward. You know, are we going to do some of that next year? I don't know. Maybe, you know, a temporary sugar high and, hey, we expanded the monetary supply by 25%, but here's your couple $100 for, you know, extra stimulus unemployment. I mean, that kind of stuff, I think, has scarring consequences to the psyche of American workers and American people. So, you know, that is something that I do watch and pay attention to, and we all do. But, you know, I'll get off my soapbox for a minute there. Also on the employment front, Oxford Economics predicts employment really won't recover to pre-pandemic levels until 2023. We saw in December some job losses rather than gains, so we're starting to see that V-shaped recovery slow down on employment. So we'll keep an eye on that, but hopefully we are moving at a faster pace than we were with the recovery coming out of the 2008-2009 Great Recession. One thing of note, so the yield curve has been steepening lately. So we're seeing yields increase further out on the yield curve in 10s, 30s. Possible reason for that, hey, people don't want to be in these bonds anymore. You're selling.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, the 30-year Treasury yield is over 1.9. And as it does steepen, it will have people come back and buy treasuries because they're getting paid something, whereas before they weren't. It's important to note that 30-year treasury was down as low as it, the lowest it got was 0.7. So to be at 1.9, that's almost three times where it was. So more than anything, it just signals to me that the economies are going to open up. I think, you know, look for mid-March when it's warm most places other than the Midwest and the Northeast, And we'll see. We'll just see. And that's two more months of vaccinations.
Yep. Well, and another positive side effect of this yield curve steepening is that financials have done pretty well. So there's an opportunity to make some net interest margin now. So financials are starting to come back a little bit. Inflation, again, you know, we expanded the monetary supply by 25%, still hadn't seen any real inflation. We're below historic norms in terms of inflation. That's the thing I think everybody's got their eye on. You know, we're hearing rumblings of it, but it really hasn't come across in the official numbers yet.
One of the reasons is there's four components of the headline CPI calculation that are in deflation, contracting, and it's because of COVID, the shutdown economy. If things open up in the next 90 to 120 days, as people get the vaccinations, the weather warms up, you're probably going to see the CPI go north a little bit. Some say up to 3%. But today's missive from David Rosenberg, he said fade inflation. So if we had our macro maven, Glenn Moore, on the podcast, we would get his thoughts on that. But, you know, David Rosenberg's a pretty smart guy. He's right more often than he's wrong.
Right, right. Well, and also earlier this year, the Fed came out and said that they're potentially going to let inflation run hot for a little bit, move to a method of inflation targeting over a rolling periods of time rather than a hard line in the sand. Hey, once we get 2%, we're going to start raising rates.
There's no better way to monetize away $30 trillion in debt than create inflation.
That's
and
right.
Pay it back with cheap dollars.
That's right. I mean, that's
been done before.
That's really the only way other than maybe a debt holiday after a big nasty war. But
yeah.
Yeah, so you got to inflate our way out of a crisis. So that's I think, what everybody's hoping for. Last thing I do want to mention, the Great Reset. So you're starting to see this term more and more out there in the general populace. So not to pat myself on the back and talk about how smart I am, but back in May, one of our first podcasts that we did, I talked about the Great Reset. This was the Great Reset is the World Economic Forum's policy agenda. And basically, it's all about don't let a good crisis go to waste. Hey, thank God for COVID, because now we can tear the system down and rebuild it back the way we want it. You know, and there's some good elements to this. You know, it's they talk about, you know, addressing inequality and clean air and clean water, you know, and then always on the surface, there's some good elements to this. But more and more as the Biden administration has been out speaking and talking about policy and that type of thing, you can literally see word for word that they're reading out of the World Economic Forum's playbook. Specifically the Great Reset. So you know, I just want to plant the seed there. If you're interested in what all these global elites, you know, owners of leaders of industry and state across the world are thinking and what they talk about behind these closed shadowy doors, check out the World Economic Forum. They have a website. You can read all their policy papers there. But the thing that's kind of been interesting and surprising to some degree for me is a lot of the Biden policies are straight out of the playbook. So I'm at some other point, it probably makes sense to go through what all those policies are. Today's probably not the venue, but I just want to plant the seed for the future.
Seed well planted.
All right. So thanks for watching. Obviously COVID-19 developments, vaccine distribution, how soon we can get everybody inoculated, potentially for nationwide lockdown. You know, the Biden administration said that they would do that. They've been somewhat quiet on that recently. I would have to think that that would have some pretty nasty economic consequences and potentially also for the stock market, but we're keeping our eye on that. Earnings valuation metrics. So again, hey, we're in another earnings season. We're starting to see year-end earnings. We're expecting things to look a little bit better than they did in the middle of the crisis. The forward guidance will be interesting to pay attention to. Employment, we're starting to see employment gain slow. We're starting to see more losses, so we're keeping our eye on that. Obviously, inflation. I think once we start to see that spark up, a lot of really smart people think that that may spiral out of control pretty quickly. Also, we mentioned this last time we discussed this, ESG, environmental, social, and governance investing, the popularity of that. Also, infrastructure spending under the new administration. Joe, anything else on your mind?
The only other thing I have to say today is Roll Tide.
Roll Tide.
National champs.
That's right. That's right. Congrats, guys.
Half the team's going to be in the NFL first round draft, it looks like. Half the offense.
I wonder if they're going to play next year.
They'll play in the pros.
They'll probably be first in line for the vaccine, whereas we'll be in the end. All right, folks, that'll do it for today. We appreciate your time. If there's anything we can do for you, please don't hesitate to reach out and visit our website, wealthqb.com. Thanks.
The information in this podcast is presented for educational and entertainment purposes only and is subject to change without notice. Opinions expressed are those of the participants and don't necessarily reflect those of Gordon Asset Management, LLC, its producers, hosts, or guests. Information presented should not be construed as tax, legal, or investment advice, or a recommendation or solicitation for the sale of any product or strategy. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from qualified professionals to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Investments involve risks. Neither Gordon Asset Management, LLC, nor its podcast participants shall be liable for losses resulting from decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on this podcast.